Welcome, fellow nature enthusiasts, to the Electrifying Conservationists Assembled podcast. Join us in uniting with the planet's bravest wildlife defenders to raise awareness and ignite change for the survival of all our animal friends. Whether you're a seasoned conservationist or new to the animal kingdom, this podcast is where your inner animal fan can run wild. Today, we're diving into the world of the Malayan tapir with our special guest, Diana Cobb. What's in store for you today? Well, get ready as Diana and I discuss everything about the only tapir species found outside of South and Central America. Let's welcome Diana to the Conservationist Assembly podcast. Diana, thank you for joining us on the podcast today. How's it going?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really, really good. Thank you. I'm excited to have you here. To talk about Malayan tapirs. Certainly, I think they're quite a visually striking animal, and I'm sure that we're going to learn about the personality that just captures the heart of everyone that has the opportunity to work with them. So, I guess first and foremost, can you tell us about Malayan tapirs?
Yeah, so Malayan tapirs are one of the 4 to 5 extant tapir species that we have, and they're the only ones that are not from America. So they live in Southeast Asia. At the moment, you only have populations in Thailand, Myanmar, Malaysia, and Indonesia. There used to be more, and there used to be a bigger distribution, but right now it's quite small, and the populations are small as well and very fragmented. They are the largest tapir species that we have, and also have this distinct coloration, the saddlecloth shape. This is why in German, for example, we call them Schabrackentapir, because Schabracke means saddlecloth, actually. And yeah, as all tapir species, they are so-called living fossils. So they have existed more or less exactly like they are now for millions of years, and they didn't really change much from their appearance, which is quite fun too.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think it's, yeah, just down to how well designed they are that obviously they haven't needed that change. And it's just so cool to think about, like you say, they are walking fossils and are so well designed that they haven't needed to change. So you've thank you for that introduction. First and foremost, it's a great insight into the Malayan tapir, and obviously a large part of why we're talking about them today is because they're not doing too well in the wild, and you've started touching on their fragmented populations. So what role do they play within their wider ecosystem?
So it's not really clear what kind of ecological role they really play. So if they really are seed dispersers, that's not really clear, but they do make a lot of changes within the habitat to all the plants that they eat. They're browsers, so they really like to nibble on all sorts of plants on their way, and they also can really bend and push down even bigger stems. So they are kind of the gardeners in their ecosystem. But I'm not sure what their real ecological role apart from this is. They are also, of course, a prey species for bigger predators. But since they're quite large and can also be aggressive and are really, really quick to flee, they can also swim and dive very well. So they are also, I think, a difficult prey species for their predators as well.
So what might those predators be? Because like I say, they are quite large. So what animals might you find at least attempting to predate on a Malayan tapir?
So I think it's mostly tigers that would prey on Malayan tapirs. But there have been, I think dholes could also sometimes be considered a predator species, or leopards.
Okay, I suppose, yeah, yeah. If they've got juveniles around, there might be interesting to learn about what animals they might encounter in their habitat. So what are the classification, or what are Malayan tapirs classified as?
So they belong to the Perissodactyla, which are the which are a group that consists of horses, rhinos, and tapirs, basically. So a lot of people, when they come to the zoo, they're not really sure what the tapir is. They often think it's some kind of pig-related species. Yeah, but they're not. And as I said, there are four to five. We're not sure about this fifth species of tapir. It's not been really declared a proper species, but there are at least three other tapir species within the group of tapirs.
So not only walking fossils, also quite unique then in the sense that they're from a small group of or a small family of animals when you consider hoofstock as a larger clade or group of animals, but they only come from the family of horses and rhinos. They are quite unique then.
Definitely, yeah. That's also, I mean, their look is quite unique with their proboscis, which they can use like as a snorkel, for example, which is also quite fun. And their how they process their food is similar to horses. So that's quite interesting on the veterinary side that they can be compared to horses in a lot of ways in their feeding and also sometimes in their behavior.
Right, so then we know that they're not doing too well in the wild. What are some of the actions that zoos are doing to help give a better chance of survival for Malayan tapirs?
So in Malayan tapirs, I have to admit that the zoos are a bit struggling at the moment. For example, REP is struggling to, or in the process of finding an in situ partner. We're currently still working mainly on the ex situ population, so having this population as a reserve for later introductions maybe, but at the moment there have been some action plans going on in the in range countries, so they will try to reduce the destruction of the habitat, fragmentation. They try to work on how to avoid traffic accidents, which also happen quite often with Malayan tapirs, unfortunately. And we're trying to find a partner in situ so that we can exchange expertise and also give financial aid to the population, because we want to view within the one plan approach, we'd like to view the whole population, like the ex situ and the in situ population together. So that's where we're currently.
So, from the EEP standpoint, how many kind of Malayan tapirs are we looking at in European zoos?
So what's interesting about the Malayan tapir EP is that we're not only situated in Europe, but we also have two zoos in Asia, Singapore Zoo and Taipei Zoo, which is great because they have a lot of tapirs and they breed very well, and they have, of course, great environment for the tapirs. The only problem is that the transfers between those regions are very difficult, and yeah, we're having a few problems now with the new European health law, animal health law, to get this going, because of course we want to transfer individuals and transfer genetics between the regions. But in any way, we have now in the whole EEP population, we have 62 animals, and in Europe it's around 40. So that's great. But we do want to go much higher with the numbers. So we would like to increase the population as far as we can.
Perfect. And yeah, I'm sure hopefully with through hard work and perseverance, that transition from or for mixing the genetics in Southeast Asia and the European bloodlines will happen. And it will be better for everyone when it does. So aside from the EEP, what other work do zoos do or kind of help contribute to in Malayan tapir conservation?
So there's a project going on that's managed by Copenhagen Zoo. They have this Southeast Asia program, And so we're working very closely with them to get things in situ, coordinated with the EEP. And of course, Malayan tapirs are also a great species for education and for research. So that's also something that we really focus on for husbandry, but also for the reproduction. So, as I said, it's very difficult right now to transfer animals between regions, but if we were able to do artificial insemination and be more have more expertise in that field, it would be much easier maybe to only transfer semen, for example. So that's also something that we'd have to look at, also together with the in situ population maybe, and with other zoo regions like the Asian zoos that are not members of the EEP. But also husbandry, for example, enrichment studies have been done. And yeah, there's a lot of potential there as well.
Fantastic. And yeah, it's certainly interesting to hear about some of the things that maybe slip beneath the radar when you think about what zoos do. Certainly research and all of these things that go on behind closed doors don't often get brought to light. So thank you for telling us about that. So what's your favorite fact about Malayan tapirs?
I think my favorite fact is, like, I think many people, something many people love about tapirs is that they have this habit of going into a trance when you stroke them. And it's particularly funny to me because, as we already mentioned, they are 50 million years old. So why do they do this? We don't know this, but as soon as you stroke a tapir on its back or even like anywhere really, some of them or many of them will just sink down, fall asleep, and you can really do anything with them. We did veterinary exams, you can draw blood, you can do ultrasounds, you can do a lot, and they're just asleep and they love it. And I think that's very funny about this species, and they're huge, and they're also really dangerous. So they can really bite and hurt people if they don't want something done to them, but they really like this stroking. So whenever we talk about like medical training, usually you would have to do conditioning and target training and stuff, but with tapirs, you really just have to pet them, and then you can do anything if they let you. So some may be a bit spooked, but it's really, I don't know, I really like that about them.
Yeah, and sounds ideal. And certainly, I suppose then when you're, like you say, talking about doing it for veterinary purposes, like taking a blood draw, the results from that are going to be a lot more accurate because the animal wasn't stressed at the time.
Yeah, and you can do it much more regularly. You don't have to anesthetize them or sedate them. It's healthy, you know. There are no risks to the doing this, and it's also, of course, great for the staff that works with them because it's just a nice interaction, and it's pleasurable for the tapir. It's not something that they hate. So, like many other medical procedures, might be a bit,
Yeah, I'm sure
uncomfortable,
everyone's.
but those are just nice, so
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm sure everyone's lining up to go and scratch a tapir because the
Yeah.
vet's here. So, what was your first experience with Malayan tapir?
My first experience directly with the Malayan tapir was probably when I started my job here. And I already knew that I was going to take over the EEP, so I was excited. I already really liked tapirs before I started, but this was also great point for this job that I would be the EEP coordinator. And I remember that we had a late transport, and we were receiving some fish from another zoo, and we had to stay in the tapir house where we would slowly get them into the water. And whenever we were waiting, we could just go up to our female pinola who was standing there waiting to be scratched, and then we could scratch her and then go back to the fish and then go back to pinola. And it was a really calm and nice evening at the zoo.
Yeah, she sounds lovely. So as soon as there's a keeper present, she's just there demanding attention.
Yeah, so she was a single female. Now we currently have a pair and a small calf,
Oh,
which is
fantastic.
wonderful. Yeah, she was so she was very, very used to being pet and touched, and she loved it. But now it's a bit they also are really well habituated to humans, but of course it's a bit more dangerous when you have several animals. But Pinola was I don't think she ever. She was just calm and nice and super fun, yeah.
And so, thank you for telling us a little bit about Malayan tapirs. We're now going to just transition into to discussing your journey into to where you are in your career. So, yeah, if you could just give us a bit of background on yourself and how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, so I'm a biologist. I work as a curator now in at Nuremberg Zoo. I'm a general curator, so I am, yeah, I care about all or care for all our species basically. I started loving zoos when I was little, of course, and already when I was at school, I had this project that was already about a certain topic that we could choose, and I did mandrills at a zoo and their behavior, and that's where my passion kind of started. And then I studied biology, and then in my master's, I went to university in Göttingen where I studied behavioral biology, and I was also able to do multiple subjects at the German Primate Center, which is an institution that closely works with the University of Göttingen. And we did a lot of smaller projects and like courses that involved primates. We went to this monkey mountain, it's called. No, it's a walkthrough Barbary macaque exhibit in Germany, and we did some behavioral research there. And then I worked at the German Primate Center for my master thesis, and I looked at rhesus macaques, and this was really fun and interesting. And I thought I always wanted to work with animals, but when you study biology, you realize that that's not really something that biologists do most of the time. They rather work in labs, and it's not this notion that people have, like what biologists really do. And then I thought maybe a zoo could be something that makes sense. And I did an internship at Frankfurt Zoo, and I realized very quickly that this was the best job I could imagine. This was the, yeah, it was just so much fun and so many different things that you had to do, and that you could, yeah, your day was just different every day. And then I did another internship at Heidelberg Zoo and another internship at Landau Zoo. And then I just, in the end, landed here in Nuremberg as a curator. And yeah, so I've been here for 3 years now. Feels like no time has passed. Feel like I just started, but no, it's been amazing. And I love this job so much. I always, tell everyone that this is the best job ever, and most people believe me immediately because when I tell about my everyday work life, they always look at me like, "Oh, you do this at work? That's impressive. That's great.
Yeah.
I wish I could do stuff like that at work."
Yeah, it does certainly, when you work with animals, it does certainly get a lot of people's attention. So, has there been, obviously, we know that you're the Malayan tapir EP and you've always had a fondness for tapirs. Have there been any other particular individuals or species that you gained a particular attachment or a relationship with?
So I mean, whenever you really spend more time with a certain species or individual, I feel like you start appreciating them more and become closer to them in every way. So I think every species that I've worked with here has been kind of special to me. But most recently, I've been interested in our reptiles because we're changing the our collection plan, and there's been a lot going on with different species, and our blue tree monitors have really become my favorite at the moment because they are so amazing. I don't know. I could look at them all day, and yeah, those are kind of my precious animals at the moment that I show very proudly to everyone who's visiting. And I was like, "Look at my tree monitors. Have you seen them?" And a
Yeah,
lot of
it's
people, zoo people, always get it, but non-zoo people are a bit confused sometimes.
definitely hard to get a good amount of people interested in certainly reptiles and amphibians and invertebrates. But I think that attitude is changing slowly, and certainly when they're a bright coloured like a monitor lizard, it certainly does help draw people's attention to them. And they're quite active and they're quite cheeky, can't they, monitor lizards be? So yeah, I understand why you like them. So what is your favourite part of your role?
Oh, I think, oh, that's difficult, but I think that you are able to support projects from the very beginning to maybe not the end, but when we start planning an enclosure and you know, okay, we have to look at every little detail that's going to go in there, and then that's finished, and then the first animals can come, and you will have to organize what animals they are, how we're going to transport them. Then you bring them into the enclosure, and they have to get to know the enclosure. Everything has to work out. They have to be socialized with each other, which can also be very interesting and exciting and difficult at times. And then when they reproduce and you have offspring, that's even greater. But if you can then do introductions, reintroductions to the wild, and you've seen this whole process of caring for them and reproducing and then sending them off to like a huge conservation role, that's really amazing. I think it's hard to find something that feels that great. And we do quite a lot of reintroductions in Nuremberg, especially in Europe. And that's also, it's just a great feeling.
Yeah, I'll happily build on that. So what are some of those reintroduction program or species that you've reintroduced that you're particularly proud of?
We regularly reintroduce so what's the English name? So we regularly reintroduce bearded vultures
Really cool.
in the Alps. We did some European pond turtles, which we also do regularly almost every year. We have and regularly do reintroduce European ground squirrels to Czech Republic. It's always fun. We also do alpine ibex regularly, which is always beautiful because they go up into the mountains with a helicopter, which is quite spectacular. And also just recently we brought some of our northern bald ibis to Spain.
Great. Yeah, so thank you for highlighting some of those projects because it's really important to talk about them. So what surprised you most when you first started your career?
What surprised me most? Maybe that, yeah, how long maybe everything really takes. You often hear about people that don't know a lot about zoos, like, why don't you just reintroduce the species or these animals? Or I don't know, just build a new enclosure. And this really takes very, very long, all of it, especially if it has to have like scientific support, if it has to be scientifically connected, and all those reintroduction projects have been going on for those that are really successful now, been going on for many, many years, and people are there full time working on them. So you tend to underestimate how many people and how long stuff like this really takes, and that it's not just wishful thinking and just doing it, but yeah, there's a lot, and it's also very expensive.
Yeah, as much as we don't like to admit it, funding is a huge part of every industry, but certainly, you know, this industry where we rely on donations and all of these projects and research, like say, isn't cheap.
Yeah.
So what is some of the best advice you received from a mentor or colleague in this industry?
I would say probably that if you don't know something or you're not sure, to just admit it, because we have this great community of zoo people who all have incredible expertise and incredible knowledge of different things, and they're always happy to share this knowledge. So whenever you're not sure, this can happen. We have a lot of species, and nobody's an expert on all of them. And especially for someone like me who hasn't worked in zoos for a very long time, I don't have a lot of experience with most of these animals. So having colleagues and other zoo people who have a lot of experience with those species is so valuable. So you can always say, well, I don't know this, but I know somebody who might know it, and I can ask them. And this is very helpful, and it goes a long way. I think everybody's always happy to help.
Yeah, I can agree with that. It's one of the most motivating things about this industry is that everyone is in it together, like you say, and yeah, the network of zoos globally is incredibly strong at the moment. So with that's given us a really nice insight into your background and how you go about your role. So we're just going to finish up on the episode with some light-hearted questions, just to finish on a high. So, Diana, are there any dream species that you'd love to see in the wild?
I really like to see puffins in the wild. I've been to several cliffs looking for puffins and I never saw them. And that's something I'd really like to see. It's not like I don't have to travel far to see puffins, but I still haven't seen them, so that's great. I really would like to.
And is there one country or continent that you'd love to spend an extended amount of time?
I have a lot of countries on my list. I think for going there for a longer period of time, I'd really like to see New Zealand, and I think it only makes sense if you go there for a few weeks or months, because traveling there from Germany, I think Germany
Yeah.
is the furthest away from New Zealand in the world or something I've heard. So yeah, that would be great. But I'd also love to see some parts of Southeast Asia, especially maybe Malayan tapir habitats. But there's still a lot that I haven't seen.
I'm sure you'll get there. If you could be an animal, what would it be and why?
I think if I could be an animal, I'd probably be a bear. I'd like to be a bear. I can imagine that if you have a nice habitat like Canada or Alaska, it might be quite nice being in
Yeah,
a
can agree with
apex
it.
predator and having enough food and just being able to sleep a lot.
Yeah, I can
Yeah,
appreciate that.
I think the life quality of some bears is quite nice.
Yeah, they've got it made. They've certainly found a niche and done very well with it. So when you're not working, Diana, how do you keep busy?
I really like spending time with my dog or with horses, so also animal lover in private. And I also like to draw and paint. which is also can be combined with animals as well. So basically the same hobbies as my job, and I sometimes combine them to for projects at work. It sometimes makes sense. I've designed some signage in zoos by drawing like macaques or mangabeys or something.
No, that's really cool. And yeah, obviously, I suppose when artwork with art, you focus on what inspires you and motivates you. So then it's not surprising that a lot of your artwork would reflect animals. So that's really, really great. And last question for you, Diana, what is one thing you think our listeners should take away from today's episode?
Maybe that conservation is a group effort, and that a lot of people are involved in saving species, and that it's important that all those people work together, and that zoos have certain roles that they fulfill, and then working together with in situ conservation experts makes us all work together to save species. So it's a big puzzle, and everyone's one piece, and everybody has different things they bring to the table. So I think that's really important to keep in mind.
No, that's incredibly wise, and there's always room for everyone to get involved. So with that, Diana, you have answered my last question for you in our conversation today. So thank you so much for your time, talking about these truly amazing species and some of the work that goes on behind closed doors. We'll be sure to keep a close eye on everything that's happening in the world of Malayan tapirs and the incredible work of zoos fighting for their survival.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was really fun.
So I've got another poem for you to finish the episode on this week. Again, from the book Two Steps Behind, which is a collection of poems about rare and endangered species written and illustrated by Dawn Lawrence. And obviously fitting in with today's episode, we've got one on the tapir. So this is The Tapir by Dawn Lawrence. I've got the body of a pig. I'm not a pig, of course. I look more like an anteater, but I'm closer to a horse. If the horse in prehistoric times had stayed where it should be, in the jungle where I am today, it might have looked like me. I'm related to the rhino, I think that you will find, with 4 toes on my front feet and 3 on those behind. A trunk is where my nose should be, a kind of rubbery hose, much smaller than an elephant's, but useful, I suppose. I use it when I sniff out food to reach the leaves of trees. I grab, then place them in my mouth and hope that I won't sneeze. I trot and gallop like a horse, we're cousins, I've heard tell, but I can walk on riverbeds and feed down there as well. My swimming skills are excellent, it's water I love best. I'm either in or under it, except when I'm at rest. You might just catch me lazing if the sun is extra hot, but don't think that I'm lazy, that's one thing I am not. You've got no chance of catching me if I should choose to run. There might be races everywhere a tapir could have won. I'm such a curious sight to see, my front is coloured black, the rest of me, a ghostly white, is saddled on my back. That's why the moonlight suits me well, with shadows round each tree. So if a ghostly shape slips past, you'll never know it's me. And that brings this episode of the Conservationist Assemble podcast to a close. I am your host, Johnny Bloxham. As always, thank you so much to every one of you for tuning in. If you did enjoy this episode, please like, share, and leave a review. It really helps get the word out, helps us to keep making more content and bring that awareness and education and the stories of our guests to the masses. And always, as I say, there is plenty of opportunities for you to get involved with the podcast should you feel inclined to. If you have any questions that you'd love to have asked on the episode to a guest, or a species that you'd love to see represented, or you know, you've got pictures of Malayan tapirs that you would love to feature on the podcast social media, then you can DM us on Instagram or email us on conservationsassemble@outlook.com. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you. But until next time, thank you again for listening, and I hope you will enjoy future episodes.